Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, as California burns, the president goes after Obamacare, the Iran deal, Puerto Rico, the press, his Secretary of State, the Clean Power Plan, and Harvey Weinstein sickens. It's been the deadliest week of wildfires in California's history. Here's State Senator Kevin De Leon surveying the destruction in Napa Valley.
This is absolutely devastating. It's heartbreaking. It is crushing. This looks like another planet when you see these homes that have been reduced to rubble.
Republican Senator Bob Corker said President Trump risks starting World War III.
Sometimes I feel like he's on a reality show of some kind, and he doesn't realize that we could be heading towards World War III with the kind of comments that he's making.
And many more allegations of sexual harassment, assault, rape against Harvey Weinstein. In a 2015 NYPD sting operation, he's on tape here with Filipina-Italian model Ambra Batilana Gutierrez.
Why did you do that? You touch my priest.
Oh, please, I'm sorry. Just come on. I'm used to that.
Are you used to that?
Yes, come in.
This hour, On Point, the week in review with Rich Lowry, Kathy Gilsonen, and more. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you make of the president's moves this week on health care, on Iran, on the Clean Power Plan? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from New York is Rich Lowry, editor of the National Review. Rich, welcome back to On Point.
Hello.
Thanks for being here. From Washington, Kathy Gilsonen joins us, senior editor at The Atlantic, where she oversees the global section, Foreign Affairs. Kathy Gilsonen in Washington, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Rich and Kathy.
Let's go first. There is a lot on the table this week. Let's go first to health care. A couple of big steps this week. The president weighing in, allowing people to get into associations that would take them out of the Obama health care pool, in effect, and allow them cheaper and probably thinner health care coverage. And then, in the last 24 hours, saying he would take away the subsidies. He has, with the stroke of a pen, taken away the subsidies for low-income Americans under the Obama health care plan, the Affordable Care Act. Here he was on Thursday signing that executive order, making it easier for individuals and small businesses to buy alternative health insurance plans. Here he was before that signing.
Since I became president of the United States, I just keep hearing repeal, replace, repeal, replace. Well, we're starting that process, and we're starting it in a very positive manner.
Pushback, certainly from the Democrats at a press conference yesterday. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi said the president is undermining the ACA with his latest moves.
It is a sabotage of the Affordable Care Act, and quite frankly, a real disservice to the American people, many of whom voted for him.
Rich Lowry with the National Review. The president was not able in Congress to repeal and replace. Is he now, this week, effectively beginning the takedown of the Affordable Care Act with these steps?
Well, the law is going to be further destabilized by these steps. The executive order yesterday, I think, is a very sound policy move. It will create more options for people to have what would, in an ideal world, be really what health insurance is, which is a stopgap against catastrophic events and catastrophic costs rather than something that pays for routine expenses. The move that's coming to cut off the subsidies is legally, I think, something that has to happen. A judge has ruled these subsidies unconstitutional and ordered that they should stop. But politically, and in the real world, the consequences should be pretty severe. These payments were covering for some of the economic irrationality of Obamacare and cushioning people from what naturally would have been the premium spikes if these subsidies didn't exist. So we'll begin to see those premium spikes. There'll be a lot of pressure on Republicans. It'll create this narrative of sabotage. We heard from that clip of Nancy Pelosi, and President Trump might imagine that this will pressure Republicans to you know, get their act together and repeal and replace, it's much more likely to pressure them to buckle to Democrats and go along with a bipartisan deal to stabilize the system that probably would have been considered distasteful to most Republicans, you know, a month ago.
Jack, without that kind of congressional intervention, after the steps the president has taken this week, do you see the Affordable Care Act coming apart?
Well, that's what experts predict. On the first announcement, the allowing people to have short-term plans and associations to form to buy insurance, the American Cancer Society said fears that patients and survivors will be unable to access meaningful coverage. The American Academy of Family Physicians warns that these narrow plans will cause significant economic harm to women and older, sicker Americans because, of course, the short-term plans allow healthier, younger people to get out, to come on and have their own plan, and leaving the sicker and older people in the Obamacare plan. And then the second announcement, the first announcement that could take a year or more to go into place. Mm-hmm. But as I understand it, the ending subsidies could happen now. And according to Julie Rovner, our Kaiser healthcare news person, former NPR mm-hmm. expert on this, this is going to affect 7 million people almost immediately. It could. And most of them, she said, or a lot of them are in red states and are people who voted for Mr. Trump. Not only that, are they apt to lose coverage or pay more for it, but because ending the subsidies will force the insurance companies to raise premiums, the cost to the federal government will go up, Kaiser predicts, $2 billion next year and $365 billion over a decade to sort of pay for this, it seems to me, spiteful effort to spike Obamacare.
Rich, remind us where the weight of that falls. This is sort of on the working poor, right? This is 100 or 200% of the poverty level, so that's people making $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year.
Correct. But let's not make any mistake, though. This is a system that was not well designed in the first place. And the idea was that you would make health insurance – this wasn't the explicit idea, but how it actually worked out in reality – you'd make health insurance unattractive to young and healthy people because it would be too expensive and include all sorts of benefits that they didn't want, and then force them with a fine to pay health insurance because buying health insurance would be so much less attractive for them. And you do it with a fairly weak and small fine. So what's been the result is that young and healthy people have not bought into Obamacare in such a way to make it sustainable. So the system had slowly been unraveling prior to this. This will make it even less stable, and Congress should create a better system. But Republicans can't get their act together, and it's to do it on their own. And a bipartisan compromise that does anything other than try to reapply some Band-Aids here, I think, is unlikely.
What happens, Rich, and Kathy, I want to come to you, but what happens if, because there are many ways now in which the Trump administration is going after the Affordable Care Act, moving people away from regular access to the website where they can sign up and taking away the marketing so people know about that, and lots of ways. What happens if Congress doesn't get its act together? Could we just have healthcare chaos at this end of the market?
Yeah, the individual market will be even less attractive than it is now. And the prior to this, at least Republicans didn't have ownership of healthcare. They had failed on their own terms and failed to deliver a promise that they had repeated, often thoughtlessly or even dishonestly in some cases, for 7 years. And now they'll actually own a status quo that's going to be even worse than the one existing now.
Kathy Gilson at The Atlantic, I know foreign affairs are your meat and potatoes, but Rich says Americans should look more toward catastrophic stopgap coverage when it comes to health care. Do you think that's what Americans have in mind when they think of health care, insurance, coverage?
Well, I think that is broadly how insurance works. It's you pay into a system that that pays out in the event of emergency.
Yeah, but Kathy, if I may, I don't know about you. That's not true for me. I have insurance, and when I go in for regular checkups, it pays a significant portion of that. When I go in, if I get an infected cut and I go in, it pays for a portion of that. It's not only when I have some major situation.
Right, that's true. I think the idea is basically, though, that insurance is meant economically to smooth out the costs of catastrophically expensive things. And that, you know, in covering some of these routine things, the point of covering routine things is so that you can prevent catastrophic things from happening by means of things like, you know, regular visits to the doctor, getting your cut checked out when it gets infected. I do think that, you know, that Americans, not having spoken to many Americans about how they feel about their right to health care and things like that, there is a sense in which people do want various options of the kind of coverage they want to get, particularly young, healthy people. I think, you know, and this was a problem when Obamacare was being debated in the first place, question why they should have to pay into a system more money to cover people that are using more healthcare and more expensive healthcare than they are, and then they're going to have to pay. So, you know, it's the politics, I think, to some extent remains the same as it was when we were debating Obamacare in the first place, except with the important exception that there is now this entitlement that people are used to being able to draw on. And obviously, when you're going to take away something that people already have, it's much more politically difficult than not giving it to them in the first place.
Jack Beatty, the president, was very clear on the campaign trail. He wanted to dismantle the Affordable Care Act. But here we are, and it is kind of by executive order. Of course, he's criticized Obama for executive order, but it is kind of coming apart here. I don't feel any guarantee that Congress will fix this. What are we at risk of losing immediately, Jack, in terms of the stability of American health care? And what about the longer-term vision here? Is it catastrophic, cheap, and then and good luck to you, cheaper, as Rich says? Or, you know, there was another vision during the Obama years of more comprehensive coverage that would make healthier people, and we get on that road. Very expensive, but that's where we were headed.
And I think that's where the politics are headed. I mean, Bernie Sanders has already made it, you know, practically writ among Democratic candidates. Healthcare is a right for everybody, Medicare for all. He sees that as the direction of the Democratic Party, while the Republican Party seems to be moving toward this kind of sabotage of Obamacare.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
Hi, everyone. This is Tom. Just a quick message before we get back to the show. I'm inviting you to stick around at the end of this podcast for an excerpt from another NPR show, Only a Game. Here's why. This weekend, Only a Game is examining power and corruption at the NCAA after the FBI arrested 10 people, including 4 college basketball coaches, for allegedly accepting bribes. College players and their families are vulnerable. Listen for a sneak preview of Only a Game's episode, Power, Money, and Corruption, the Exploitation of College Athletes, at the end of our show. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news with Rich Lowry, editor of the National Review, Kathy Gilsonen, senior editor at The Atlantic, overseeing the global section there, Foreign Affairs. Jack Beatty is here, and you can join us as well. It has been a heck of a week. The president cutting health subsidies for the poor, making some big changes on the Affordable Care Act front by executive order. Decertifying, today's the day for that, we're told, the Iran deal. Smacking around Puerto Rico a little bit, talking about helping them as well, but some tough language there. Senator Bob Corker, Republican, saying Trump risks starting World War III with his public language and comments. Trump, I'm facetious, I guess, but still challenging the Secretary of State to an IQ test after the reports that Rex Tillerson called him a moron. Trump threatening the free press in very specific terms. We'll talk about why, but kind of remarkable language there. We've got the Clean Power Plan scrapped this week, California burning, and all of us with that on our minds. And of course, yes, the Harvey Weinstein sexual harassment, assault, rape. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Will the president's moves kill Obamacare? And where does decertifying Iran's compliance take us on that front? Is the president right to smack Puerto Rico around a little this week? And how are you taking all this Trump turmoil, can we call it that, on board? Is this the Make America Great that you voted for? Are we in trouble here? Is the White House, the president, the country in some kind of special trouble at this moment? I want to look at that big question, but a couple of other specific points first. The president tweeting this week on Puerto Rico, quoting people saying that they survived the hurricanes, but now they've got a financial crisis of their own making. Their infrastructure was a disaster before the hurricane. Tweeting, we cannot keep FEMA, the military and first responders, in PR Puerto Rico forever. New York Democratic Congressman Nydia Velazquez responded to that, outraged here, said it was to kick fellow citizens when they're down is shameful. She said, and continued here.
The most basic fundamental responsibility of the president of the United States, the president of the most powerful country in the world, is to show up and make and provide the assistance and the relief that American citizens need. They don't need this type of insult. And by the way, why is it that he doesn't put the same tweets when it comes to Texas or Florida?
There was the congresswoman yesterday at the House Financial Services Committee, but yesterday as well at a White House press briefing. Here was Chief of Staff General John Kelly defending President Trump's tweets about federal aid to Puerto Rico.
This country, our country, will stand with those American citizens in Puerto Rico until the job is done. But the tweet about FEMA and DOD, read military, is exactly accurate. They're not going to be there forever. And the whole point is to start to work yourself out of a job and then transition to the rebuilding process.
Jack Beatty, yes, Puerto Rico had very significant financial infrastructure projects before the hurricane. But what do you think about the president going after them? Supportive words as well. You know, I'll always be with them, he tweets. But going after them in that way this week, Jack.
Well, our friend Nancy Cordes of CBS News, a frequent contributor to this program, asked General Kelly this question. Does the president believe that Puerto Ricans are American citizens? And she asked that question because of that morning tweet, which seemed to be saying there was a different standard for Puerto Ricans than there was for people in Texas and Florida. And, of course, the general made I thought he made a pretty good point. He said, well, what the president really meant was that our armed forces can't stay there indefinitely, or FEMA can't stay there indefinitely, and indeed you want the first responders to be able to work their way out of the job. Well, that made some sense. It didn't, however, affect the influence the mayor of San Juan, Carmen Yulin Cruz, who came back and said to the president, you're incapable of empathy, and frankly, you can't get the job done. Now, this comes in a week when Tom Gelton on NPR, have reported that there are mayors in Puerto Rico who are hoarding some of the supplies that are coming in, and so that there's at least somewhere in the system some politically caused and indigenous corruption and inefficiency, but that's against the background of an overall picture of delay and perhaps even neglect in aiding that stricken island.
Rich Lowry, we've still got 80%+ of people without power in Puerto Rico, many of them having trouble getting clean water, drinking water, and all the rest. Is this the time? Is there a time for this presidential comment?
No. I think the things he said about Puerto Rico more or less are true. It suffered from catastrophic economic mismanagement, has an enormous debt problem, and it's not a very well-run place, and the infrastructure was terrible before this. But there's a time and a place to say that, and it may never be the time and place for a president to say that, certainly not in the midst of a disaster. And I read this entirely as a product of the president's thin skin and defensiveness. Once the mayor of San Juan criticized him, this was going to be his mode of operation. It's his mode of operation when anyone criticizes him. So I think it's a shame. It'd be much better if he said, look, it's a heck of a problem. You know, he correctly pointed out it's an island. It's not like Texas where you just drive the utility trucks in from other states. That's true. It's logistically difficult. But his attitude, the right attitude would just be, we're going to do whatever we can to pile into this problem and try to get the island back up and running for the good of those people as soon as possible.
That not the weight of his comments getting attention this week, certainly. Brandon in Ohio, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for taking my call. I appreciate your show. I agree with everything that your your guest is saying, you know, it's unfortunate that when we've seen the first hurricanes that had occurred in Texas that was hit, you know, we had President Trump saying, you know, let the record indicate that this is, you know, Trump, the way that Trump handles a natural disaster is the way to do it. But when we see things happening to Puerto Rico, which is certainly a different demographic, and I don't want to speculate, you know, such a different response and a lagged response. And it's really unfortunate. It's hurtful. And I don't think that his actions and his view towards the people who live in Puerto Rico reflects the larger views of Americans as a whole. And it really is sad.
We are wishing Puerto Ricans well today. We've got a lot to get to here. I want to go to it. The president today with a statement on Iran and the nuclear deal there. And as we speak, not quite out yet, but coming very soon. He talked with Sean Hannity on Wednesday about the Iran nuclear agreement, saying it was overall a bad deal.
It was an incompetently drawn deal. Look, it's a very bad deal. I'm not saying anything different tonight than I have been saying for 2 years.
Yeah.
It's a horrible, horrible embarrassment to our country. And we did it out of weakness when actually we had great strength.
Kathy Gilson, and here we're in your wheelhouse. The president to say today he will decertify. That is, he will not certify that Iran is in compliance with the terms of the deal. Now, we have heard from all over the place that, in fact, by the terms, you've got almost everybody saying they are in compliance. So what's the president up to here, Kathy?
So decertification, I think, is a procedural move that doesn't actually rip up the deal. And as I understand what the plan hasn't been announced yet, but as I understand what it's going to be is basically what Nikki Haley previewed in a speech at American Enterprise Institute a few months ago, which is basically that they're going to kick the problem over to Congress to talk about dealing with things that are not covered under the nuclear deal, which is very narrowly drawn to deal with Iran's nuclear program specifically, but not with things like its ballistic missile testing, its support for terrorist groups around the world. And notwithstanding the fact that, you know, the International Atomic Energy Agency and the European Union and various groups have certified that Iran is broadly in compliance with the deal, but for actually a few marginal violations, Trump can cite actually a provision of the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act, which was passed by Congress to make sure that the president, which I assume they assumed was going to be a Democratic president, has to certify the deal every 90 days. And it narrowly asks whether the lifting of sanctions imposed in retaliation for Iran's nuclear program is in America's national security interests. Now, the Trump administration can determine legally that it's not in America's national security interests. And what he intends to do, again, is not certify it and ask Congress to figure it out.
Rich Lowry, can you see Congress then going further down that road, picking up on the president's theme, it's Republican Congress, that this is a bad deal, and going deeper, to reinstate sanctions here, effectively blowing up the deal or not?
Well, I think the approach is going to be, and we'll have to wait and see, but to decertify, say this is not in the vital national security interest of the United States, and Trump doesn't believe that. I don't believe that. There's no reason for him to certify, I think. But that's short of getting out of the deal entirely, and they'll try to strengthen it in the ways that have just been mentioned, working with European partners. Now, whether this works or not, I have no idea. It'll require a considerable diplomatic deftness that we haven't seen yet in evidence from this administration. And I just want to pick up, Tom, and underline one point that was just made. So much of what President Obama did was premised on a Democratic president being his successor who could just bless all this unilateral action he had undertaken, much of it legally dubious.
When you say unilateral in this case, what do you mean? Because the Secretary of State went over with allies, negotiated this. What was unilateral here?
Well, I have particularly in mind that the healthcare and DACA,
not the case when it comes to the Iran deal, is it? I mean, this is a well-established precedent of American presidents in foreign policy-making agreements.
I was picking up on the point that was just made that they assumed there'd be a Democratic president who would just certify this, no questions asked. Mm. So, you know, if this were a treaty and actually had been voted on by Congress the way it should have been, it would have a status that would make it much more difficult to unravel. And the same thing is with the cost-sharing payments. If Congress had actually appropriated that money, you'd need Congress to go back and unappropriate them.
I mean, I take your point across the board, Rich.
You would need a new law.
But
so
in this
the
case,
fact is we have all this action from Trump because there is so much action unilaterally from Obama.
I mean, I take your point in other areas, but on this front, Jack, let me bring it to you, the kind of action Obama took on this particular front seems well within the range of pretty established president, Republican and Democrat presidents here. It's been a long time since we've used full-on treaties for an agreement like this. Where do you see us going here, Jack? Is this a tempest in a teapot that the president does this and Congress doesn't act and it rolls on, or something else?
Well, it sets the ground for a crisis, a crisis over nuclear weapons and over the proliferation of them, the same sort of thing we see in North Korea. And it's the last thing you would think the president wants on his plate now. And we can't divorce the president's temperament issues, to put it carefully, the issues introduced by Senator Corker into the discussion about the president's fitness for office. We can't divorce those from this decision. The Washington Post yesterday talked about the president having a tantrum when he had to sign what seems to be the case that Iran is, what is the case, according to the authorities, is observing its term, its part of this deal. Inspectors say that. And the president just hated to do that because he had spent a whole campaign, you know, attacking this as the worst deal in history and so on, and he just couldn't bear it, and he would go into these rages. And according to the Post reporting, his staff tried to do this workaround. This is an example of what Senator Corker was saying, how they're trying to manage him and keep him in the middle of the road. They try to do this workaround of let's go to Congress and have Congress deal with it, and maybe it'll, you know. In other words, this is a way of massaging the Trump temperament problem.
Temperament problem. We'll look at that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Senator Bob Corker kind of put that on the table this week with a series of comments that have got a lot of attention here. Talking about the White House being an adult daycare center, with the president, I guess, is the one being taken care of there. Talking about Secretary Tillerson, Secretary Mattis, Chief of Staff General Kelly as the people helping separate our country from chaos. And here he was in a phone interview with New York Times reporter Jonathan Martin, released this week, talking about the president's temperament.
I don't wish him harm.
Right.
I don't. But just the volatility is, you know, to anyone who has been around, is to a degree alarming. But again, I don't wish him harm. He's got people around him that have been able to keep him, generally speaking, in the middle of the road.
Right.
The tweets, especially as it relates to foreign policy issues, I know have been very damaging to him.
Kathy Gelsinen, what about this issue of temperament abroad and at home? You've got a Republican senator here talking about an alarming degree of volatility and the damage that he says has already been very damaging to the country. What about that conversation this week? Bob Corker sort of took the lid off of it, Kathy.
Sure. And this is, you know, Bob Corker saying something publicly that we've been hearing about, whispers about in Washington privately. And, you know, there have been some public comments, mostly from the Democratic side of the aisle, and obviously media commentators raising this temperament issue, raising fears of World War III ever since November 9th. But I think what's significant, of course, about Corker is that he boosted Trump during the campaign. He is the Republican chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he never said this explicitly in his interview with the New York Times with regard to the World War III comments, but it seemed pretty clear to me from reading it that he was talking about North Korea policy. And I think the big fear among people within the defense establishment, and certainly the analysts I speak to, is that with regard to the North Korea situation, the unpredictability, the fact that even according to reporting from within North Korea, the North Koreans themselves don't know who's in charge of the United States. They don't know who's setting the policy. They don't know whether to listen to the fire and fury comments or the, you know, chance for diplomacy comments. I think that's a very dangerous situation, and that the likeliest way the United States could end up in a shooting war with North Korea or worse is through some kind of catastrophic miscalculation. And when you have such unclear communication, it raises the chance of miscalculation. So that seems to be what Corker really fears. That's certainly what I really fear. And, you know, it's out in public now.
Rich, I mean, you've got a conservative publication here. You've got a Republican senator saying this. In Republican circles, do you now hear concern about the president's temperament, volatility, stability, Rich?
Oh, well, those have been concerns from the very beginning, Tom. That's nothing new. And the president, he has created this kind of culture of whispered conversations among various conservative commentators and Republican office holders, where they'll either, you know, go out in public and foursquare support what he's saying or doing, or, you know, try to evade it. And then when they're in private, they'll say, geez, we're really worried about this guy. Now, Corker,
but this week it wasn't whispered. It was right out there.
That's true.
And the issues are pretty big here. I mean, like, pay attention, people, right?
Yeah. Well, Corker, one, as just pointed out, you know, this is, he had many opportunities to say these kind of things when it would have really made perhaps a difference. And I don't think that's the case now. And the World War III thing was quite overdrawn.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, for the first time since 1986, the U.S. men's soccer team failed to qualify for the World Cup after a 2-1 loss to Trinidad and Tobago. Former American soccer player Taylor Twellman went off on the U.S. men's team.
This is an utter embarrassment. With the amount of money that is in Major League Soccer and in this sport, you can't get a draw, a tie against Trinidad? You don't deserve to go to the World Cup.
After 5 years of captivity by a Taliban link, the Haqqani group, American Caitlin Coleman, her husband Josh Boyle, and their three kids, born in captivity, were freed this week. Here's Josh's father, Jack Boyle, saying that Josh wants justice.
He was looking forward to cooperating to the fullest to provide evidence against the captors to bring them to justice for the horrendous things they did to his wife. That would have been the only time Josh lost it in 20 minutes of talking to me.
Sounds bad. And rapper Eminem went off on President Trump in a fiery freestyle rap that debuted during the BET Hip Hop Awards.
That's why he wants us to disband, because he cannot withstand the fact we're not afraid of Trump walking on eggshells. I came to stump. That's why he keeps screaming, drain the swamp, because he's in quicksand.
Eminem going off right there. We're looking at a week in the news with Kathy Gilson, senior editor at The Atlantic, Rich Lowry, editor of the National Review. Jack Beatty is here. You can join us. What do you think? Has Senator Bob Corker put the question of the president's fitness to lead squarely on the table this week? Has the president put it there? Is the president, how do you feel about the Trump administration bringing coal back this week and California burning? Is the president now attacking the First Amendment? Did you hear those comments? We'll listen to them. The freedom of the press. And was Mike Pence right to walk out of the 49ers-Colts game over taking a knee? And then there's Harvey Weinstein. Does his disgrace, will it, get men to straighten up? Let's get to our listeners. Baltimore, Curtis, thank you for calling, Curtis. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm okay. What
are
you seeing? Thank you.
Bob Corker was right on point. He's just saying what everybody is thinking. He's saying what everybody on both sides of the aisle is thinking, Republicans and Democrats alike. It's probably the one thing that they could probably come to the table and agree on if they was to just be willing to do it publicly. Trump is all over the place. I am a 6.5-year veteran, 3 deployments. Mm. And I tell you, I would hate to be a commander in charge of troops right now, because your guy that is the top chef, he's the top chief, does not properly know how to maintain, disavow orders, strategically view how things should happen and how things roll out. This guy doesn't even know what's accessible to him in terms of troop power, troop strength, how to maneuver these troops. The U.S. military can go anywhere in 18 hours around the world. They can deploy any form of
where were you deployed, Curtis? Where were you deployed?
I was in what they called Uphold Democracy, 1994, in Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
Yeah.
I was also in Dahran, during the bombing of Dahran,
right.
Cobalt Towers, in 1996.
Yeah. And what's your fear with the president then? What's your fear? What's your fear here, Curtis?
My biggest fear with the president is the president doesn't fully understand military strategy. He doesn't fully understand that America has a standing humanitarian effort that stretches far beyond national on a national level. He don't even understand a national platform of humanitarianism that we have to take care of our own.
Curtis, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Jack Beatty, do we have, I mean, Bob Corker is talking about, you know, disturbing volatility. Do we have a national security risk in the White House? These are words we hate to say, but we have to be real here.
That seems to be what people in the White House are signaling us. Michael Gerson, President Bush's speechwriter, writes today that the leaked cries for help from within the administration and the White House are, quote, revealing a president raging against enemies, obsessed by slights, deeply uninformed and incurious, unable to focus, and subject to destructive whims. That sounds pretty dangerous to the national security.
Rich, what do we do with this? The president came in, he wanted to make some big changes. He's making big changes. At the same time, you know, we as citizens, we all have to we have to care about the security of the country and its leadership. You hear Curtis there, a veteran calling in with that depth of concern. What do we do here, Rich? You got Corker saying, well, you got three guys around him sparing us from chaos, but that's not entirely comforting.
I don't have a great answer for you, Tom. His temperament, there's no question, it's a profound problem. It was clear that it was one, you know, from the day he got in the race, or actually from all of his adult life. But you do have these people around him who are highly responsible, are very experienced. Jack Kelly, Jim Mattis, Mike Pompeo, the CIA director, who have managed to forge a relationship with him and restrain his worst instincts. And that is that ideally how you want a presidency to work? No, but it's the best of the various options on the table here.
Joseph in Safety Harbor, Florida. Joseph, thank you for calling. You're on. Hi, Joseph. Are you there, my friend? Oh, boy. Joseph is talking to – Joseph, are you there? Nope. Let's go to Erica in Harvard, Massachusetts. Erica, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm frankly not surprised about the exchange between Trump and Corker. Trump has proven and continues to prove that he is volatile, and he continues to isolate himself and his supporters from the rest of the country and, I believe, the world. It's scary.
Kathy, you watch the global situation. Do you think we're being put at risk of something terrible by the volatility in the White House? Are you confident in the phalanx of folks around the president? Is the world confident about it, that it will keep us from something terrible?
Well, I do want to pick up on Rich's comment earlier that the World War III talk is probably a little bit overblown, or maybe a lot overblown. But, you know, to me, any heightened risk of nuclear war is something you want to avoid. I think it varies depending on who you talk to around the world. I think that Europeans are obviously very critical of Trump, and we'll see that today. They want to keep the Iran deal. They expect to keep the Iran deal, and they've been waging a major pressure campaign, in fact, in the United States to try to keep it. I think, on the other hand, elsewhere around the world, in the Gulf, for instance, in Asia, there's not a great deal of nostalgia for the foreign policy of the Obama administration, and people are willing to work with Trump. You know, the Saudis are very happy with what he's saying about groups like the Muslim Brotherhood. My understanding is that Japanese officials are very happy with what the Defense Department is doing to sort of flex its muscles in the South China Sea and push back against Chinese expansionism. So it's a bit more of a mixed picture than we're isolating ourselves from the world. That said, on the other hand, it's not necessarily Trump himself who is forging whatever positive relationships are being forged in the administration. It is, as Rich points out, these responsible officials around him who are doing a lot of the legwork to keep this whole thing together, which, as he says, is not ideal.
Our caller calls it scary. Diana is calling. Hi, Diana. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a clinical psychologist, and I wanted to bring up a book called Dangerous Case of Donald Trump written by 27 renowned mental health experts who all agree and make an airtight case, I believe, that he is so mentally unfit and dangerous that he should not be in office and he should be removed by the 25th Amendment. I've also signed a petition together with 62,000 other mental health workers saying that we believe he's unfit for office. I feel like our country has never faced more danger, and now the world with the threat of nuclear war, than from this really terribly, terribly unstable man.
Diana, I appreciate your call. Rich Lowry, your publication warned before the election that, conservative publication, but not for this guy, and you've warned about instability. What about the 25th Amendment? I mean, that is the one, Article 4, under which the vice president and a majority of the cabinet can agree to transfer power out of the hands of a sitting president. Can you see that coming into play during this administration? We had reports that Steve Bannon told Donald Trump that, there was a big chance that he wouldn't last his 4 years and that might be the reason why. What do you think, Rich?
No, that seems completely crazy to me. One, the 25th Amendment clearly has to do with cases where someone is just literally incapable of carrying out the duties of the presidency. This goes to personality flaws that were quite evident before the election, and people voted for him anyway. So it would have the aspect of just undoing the election because you don't like the result, and it would be incredibly divisive and destructive for the country. And look, I have my concerns about his temperament, as I said on this program, and I'm extensively on record about that. You know, the tweets are very disturbing, all the rest of it. But he hasn't actually, if you look at policy, look particularly at foreign policy, maybe with the exception of this decertification of the Iran deal, which other Republican presidents might have done, but otherwise it's been a fairly status quo foreign policy, and we haven't seen any irresponsible actions in the real world.
I don't know, but when it comes to Russia and the president's failure to name and frame and go after their intervention in our election, I would have concerns on that front. And certainly we're on different turf in North Korean terms. But then that did mount through many administrations. Dale in Franklin, Tennessee. Dale, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I think that we do ourselves a disservice as a country if we are only thinking that the only danger that that our president is causing us to face would be quote unquote World War III. I mean, think about it. His whole administration, his whole cabinet, everything is made up of people who despise and have contempt for the very agencies that they're being sworn in to protect and uphold, including climate change and a host of other areas for the quality of life, health care. I mean, it's his volatility is ever present with whatever he touches, kind of like, the Midas touch, only it's not gold.
Foreign and domestic. Dale, we've got it. I appreciate your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's get one more right here from Brian in Clinton, Iowa. Brian, what are you thinking?
Hi, Tom. I think we're headed for a disaster either way we go. If we impeach him, then we're going to have a civil war. If we keep him in there, then we're going to be at war with another country. I'm just concerned, no matter what way we go.
Jack Beatty, here we are. Mm-hmm. October 2017. We're not a year in yet since the election, or certainly not the inauguration, and things feel on tenterhooks.
They do. And Brian's point, and Rich raises it too, about removing the president from office. You know, a couple of weeks ago, Peter Hart did a focus group in Pittsburgh of Clinton voters and Trump voters. And I think there were five Trump voters. And none of them, not one of them, had heard of Robert Mueller. That's frightening. And, of course, people are busy. Life is complicated. I'm not blaming them for that. It's just that if Mr. Mueller comes out with a bill of indictment against the president, this, for many Trump supporters, is going to come from nowhere. And the kind of fear about internal division that Brian talks about, that's a very real possibility, unless there can be some way of, you know, drawing attention to the fact that there is this investigation of the president and a bomb may drop.
Hold that thought. Meanwhile, this week, we cannot ignore what's going on in California. Enormous fires there, right through wine country and beyond. All kinds of damage. Thousands and thousands of homes lost. Here's CBS News talking with a Sonoma County resident describing the wildfire's devastation in his neighborhood.
Nothing but chimneys standing. Block after block after block after block. Nothing. All just down on the ground. just black. The whole damn neighborhood's black.
And this in the same week that the Clean Power Plan is being taken down by Scott Pruitt at the EPA. There will be more coal being used as a result of that. Reports that the president this week was in Canada sitting next to Justin Trudeau, the prime minister there, talking about his unhappiness with the way a conversation he had about nuclear weapons was characterized. And in the midst of that, he went at the free press in this country. Here he was on Wednesday.
It's frankly disgusting the way the press is able to write whatever they want to write. And people should look into it.
Kathy, free press and the president. Now, he didn't like the way NBC and others reported on a meeting where he apparently they had several people telling them there was a chart about the decline in U.S. nuclear weapons over time. That's been a very deliberate effort by many administrations. It went down and down and down. He waved his hand as if to say it should go up. So they said by 10 times it was the characterization. And Trump says it's disgusting the way the press can write whatever they want to write. Where does that take us, Kathy?
I don't know exactly. It is not a good thing to hear from a president. I think, you know, it's strange to me to have to point out on the radio that the First Amendment is a thing. And that, you know, I think this is not all presidents have an adverse, adversarial relationship with the press to some degree, and frankly, depending on what party.
He's talking about pulling licenses because of this reporting, talking about shutting it down. I've got Fox News commentators saying you can't be serious.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think he can be serious. I think it's really disturbing, and I don't know what else to say about it.
Jack Beatty, we've just got a minute. Last thoughts on Harvey Weinstein. The report's tumbling out this week of many years of sexual harassment, assault, rape is on the table there. Of course, there's been a drumbeat of this across the years. You know, I mean, you know, we had Bill Clinton and his intern. We had President Trump with his own record on this and his comments about grabbing female genitalia, Roger Ailes and Bill Cosby, lots of people. But what about where this takes us this week, Jack? Does it change something?
Well, one would like to think so, but it takes place in a larger context. President Trump is an alleged sexual predator, and 60 and, you know, a majority of white women voted for him nevertheless. And maybe they didn't believe the 12 women who came forward. But that does make it seem as if even some women aren't taking this all that seriously.
Well, it sure sounded serious this week, Rich. People were up in arms over Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, and I think we'll see more revelations out of Hollywood because I just think this sets a new standard. It was an open secret. Surely there are other open secrets that remain to be exposed.
And hopefully a response that pushes back hard on this is just too much. I want to thank all of you for being here today. Rich Lowry, editor of the National Review, thank you very much for joining us, Rich.
Thanks so much.
Kathy Gilsonen, senior editor at The Atlantic. Kathy, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, thanks for joining us as always.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Hi, it's Tom. Thanks for sticking around for this preview from Only a Game special report, Power, Money, and Corruption, the Exploitation of College Athletes, available this weekend on your NPR station or podcast app.
I'm Bill Littlefield. This week on WBUR and NPR's Only a Game, we dedicate the entire hour to one question. Should college athletes be paid?
Maybe you've heard. Big-time college sports are in trouble.
Well, it's about as bad as it gets. It's not the NCAA knocking on the door, but the FBI.
The FBI is charging 10 people with fraud and corruption.
We all know this system is corrupt. Every one of us knows it.
If there's going to be a death penalty, it needs to be to amateurism. Give amateurism the death penalty, then you have a chance at creating a system free of a lot of this corruption.
But the problems with the NCAA didn't begin on September 26th when those charges were announced.
The story of the NCAA is a story of power, money, and corruption. It's been going on for a long time, and it's the athletes and their families who get hurt.
I wake up in the middle of the night dreaming that I walk in the door and he's hanging or he shot himself because he's that depressed. You put trust in these universities. You trust them with your kid on and off the court. And once you're damaged good, they just kick you to the curb.
We've spent the past few months trying to figure out how the NCAA and amateurism went wrong. And can the system be fixed, or does it need to be dismantled?
Why in the world would we have football be a part of a college? What does that have to do with education?
Litigation hasn't worked. Organization hasn't worked. Legislation, there's no way it's going to work. So the only thing that was really left was competition.
I think we are in the midst of the tipping point. The question is, how far will it tip?